Hello, welcome back to I Promise to Shoot You If You Become a Zombie. How is everyone doing today? I hope you're having a great day, and I hope that it is not as eventful as mine. My dog got out and went to visit the neighbor's kids, so that was eventful, but she's home now and everything is fine. I did not post an episode yesterday, and like I said the other day, I will probably start posting not every day, maybe twice a week, maybe once a week, just depending on the story that I'm doing at the time. So that is what's going on, and we're fixing to get started, and today is a pretty big episode. So if you are a true crime fanatic like I am, and I'm assuming you are if you're listening to this podcast, you have heard of Mara Murray. Her case has been talked about on several podcasts. She's had a documentary series episode on 2020 on Disappeared. I think there is a Netflix documentary. I mean, she's all over the place. And it is a unsolved mystery case. Like, no one knows where she's at. She's missing. And she has been missing since 2004. So, it's a long story. So, sit back. Go get you some wine. Go relax. If you're at work, put your earbuds in. And just chill with me while we talk about Mara Murray. So let's get to know her a little better before we actually get into her disappearance. So Mara Murray was born May 4th, 1982 in Hanson, Massachusetts to Lori and Fred Murray. Her siblings were Fred, Kathleen, Julie, and Kurt. Mara was raised in an Irish Catholic household, and her parents got divorced when she was 6 years old. After that, she primarily lived with her mom. She graduated from Whitman-Hanson Regional High School, where she was a star athlete on her school's track team. After that, she was accepted into the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York, where she studied chemical engineering for 3 semesters. After her freshman year at West Point, she transferred to University of Massachusetts Amherst, where she studied nursing. So it sounds like Mara was just an all-around typical girl of that time. She liked to do school. She, was academically doing well and just getting her life started, really, when she went missing. In November of 2003, like 3 months before she went missing, she had admitted to using a stolen credit card to order food from several different restaurants. That charge was continued in December to be dismissed after 3 months with good behavior. So she had a little backslide, she had a little mishap. And, we all do things that we shouldn't. We all do things that we regret. And like I said, she was young, that's no excuse, but she was, and it happened, but then, she moved on. On the evening of February 5th, Mara was on duty at her campus security job, and she spoke on the phone to her sister, Kathleen. They talked about Kathleen's relationship problems with her fiance. Her supervisor at work said around 10:30 p.m. she broke down into tears. Her supervisor said that Mara was completely zoned out when she arrived at her desk. And around 1:20 a.m., her supervisor escorted her back to her dorm. When she asked Mara what was wrong, Mara only spoke 2 words. She just said, "My sister." So no one really knew what the conversation. Mm-hmm. that Mara and Kathleen had was about until October of 2017. Her sister Kathleen said that she is a recovering alcoholic, Kathleen is, and she had just been dismissed from a rehab facility. She was picked up by her fiance, and on the way home, her fiance took her by a liquor store and it caused her to have a mental breakdown. So on February 7th, that was a Saturday, Mara's dad, Fred, arrived in Amherst. He told investigators that him and Mara went car shopping that evening and then later went to have dinner with one of Mara's friends. Sometime after that, Mara dropped her dad off at his motel and she borrowed his car, which was a Toyota Corolla, to go to a dorm party at the college. Mara arrived at the party at 10:30 p.m. that night and stayed until 2:30 a.m. Sunday morning. At 3:30 a.m. that Sunday morning, on her way back to her dad's hotel room, she hit a guardrail. The wreck was on Route 9 in Hadley. That wreck reportedly caused $10,000 worth of damage to her dad's car. So an accident report was written and taken down, but there's no report of a field sobriety test being taken. Mara was driven to her dad's hotel room and she stayed there for the rest of the morning. At 4:49 a.m. that morning, Mara borrowed her dad's cell phone to call her boyfriend, but it is unknown what they talked about. So later that morning, Fred, her dad, learned that the insurance would cover the damage to his vehicle. He ended up renting a vehicle and then took Mara back to campus that day. He then went home back to Connecticut. At 11:30 that night, Fred called Mara to remind her to get accident report forms from the Registry of Motor Vehicles. They had planned to speak Monday night again to go over the accident reports and to fill out insurance forms over the phone. So after midnight on Monday, February 9th, Mara used her personal computer to search MapQuest directions to Berkshires and Burlington, Vermont. Do y'all remember MapQuest? It just kind of tells you what the time frame was like back then. You know, nowadays kids or people can get on their phone and go to Google Maps and it will take you there every step of the way. But MapQuest, for those of y'all that don't remember or don't know, you looked it up and it told you the directions and you had to print it out to take it with you. I remember that. So the first time that anyone actually spoke to Mara on February 9th was at 1:30 p.m. She had emailed her boyfriend and it said, "I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but I honestly didn't feel like speaking to anyone. I promise to call you today though. Love you, Mara." She had also made a phone call to find out about renting a condo at the same place in Bartlett, New Hampshire, where her family had gone on vacation before in the past. Phone records indicate that phone call lasted 3 minutes, and the owner of the condo association did not rent Mara the condo. At 1:13 p.m., she called one of her classmates, but it is unknown as to what they spoke about or what the phone call was about. At 1:24 p.m., Mara emailed her work supervisor to let them know that she would be out for a week due to a death in the family, but it was later discovered that there was no death in her family. She told the supervisor that she would contact them as soon as she returned. At 2:05 p.m., she called a phone number, and it's a phone number that provides recorded information about booking a hotel in Stowe, Vermont. So it sounds like wherever she was going was in Vermont, like she was going to Vermont, but why? Why was she going there? That phone call lasted about 5 minutes. And at 2:18 p.m., she called her boyfriend, left a voice message that promised to call him later that day. That phone call was only 1 minute long. At 3:30 p.m., Mara drove off of campus in her black 1996. Saturn sedan. Classes had been canceled that day due to a snowstorm. At 3:40 p.m., she had taken out $280 from the ATM. The closed circuit footage from that video shows that at that time, Mara was alone. She then went to a nearby liquor store and purchased $40 worth of different alcoholic beverages. The liquor store's security camera also shows that Mara was alone at that time. Sometime during the day, she also went and picked up the accident forms from the Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles. She then left Amherst around 4 to 5 p.m. It is presumed that she traveled on Interstate 91 North. At 4:37 p.m., she called to check her voicemail, and that is the last reported usage of her cell phone. There is still no indication on whether or not she let anyone know about her plans to travel or where she was going. Sometime after 7 p.m. in Woodsville, New Hampshire, a local resident recorded hearing a thump outside of her house. When she looked outside her window, she could see a car up against a snowbank on Route 112. The car was pointed west on the eastbound side of the road. This lady called the Grafton County Police Department. This call was made at 7:27 p.m. According to the police report, the lady had claimed to see a man that was in the vehicle smoking a cigarette, but she later said that she did not see a man or anyone in the vehicle smoking a cigarette. She said she saw a red light that could have been a cell phone. Around the same time, another neighbor claimed to see the accident scene and saw someone walking around the vehicle. She also witnessed a third neighbor stopping at the scene. That neighbor was a school bus driver and he was returning home. He noticed that the lady in the vehicle was not bleeding, but she was cold and shivering. And he also offered to call for help, call the police, you know, to get help. And it is reported that she asked him not to call the police. And some reports that even says that she pleaded with him not to call the police. But she did say that she had already called AAA, even though AAA does not have any reports of that phone call. So the school bus driver returned home and he called the police from there because there was no cell service where he was at, where the wreck happened. This phone call was received at 7:43 p.m. and where he was, like where he was at making the phone call, he could not see Mara's car. He did notice, though, that there were several vehicles passing by the site before police arrived. Another local resident claims that they passed the scene around 7:37 p.m. He claims that there was a police SUV parked face-to-face to Mara's vehicle. She pulled over to the scene for a brief moment, but said that she saw no one inside or outside of the vehicle, so she left and went home. This witness's claim contradicts the Haverhill Police Department's report. Their police report claims that they showed up at 7:46 p.m. and there was no one inside or outside the vehicle at that time. The car had hit the tree on the driver's side of the vehicle. This severely damaged the left headlight and pushed the radiator into the fan. This made the vehicle inoperable. The windshield was cracked on the driver's side and both airbags had deployed. It is also said that the car was locked at this time. That tells me that Mara got out of that vehicle, or somebody took her out of that vehicle or whatever, but they got out and locked the door themselves. Inside and outside the vehicle, there were red stains that were thought to be red wine. Inside the vehicle, police had found an empty beer bottle and a damaged box of Franzia wine in the back seat. I hope I pronounced that last thing right. I'm not a wine drinker, so I forgive me. Police also found Mara's AAA card in her vehicle. There was also blank accident reports, makeup, CDs, diamond jewelry, driving directions to Burlington, Vermont, Mara's favorite stuffed animal, and a book. This book was titled Not Without Peril. It was about climbing the White Mountains. It was a mountain climber's guide, basically. There also happened to be items that were missing from her vehicle, including her cell phone. Also, her credit and debit cards were missing. Neither one of those had been located even to this day. There was also bottles of liquor that she had purchased earlier that day that were missing. So there were some alleged sightings of Mara after the incident between 8 and 8:30 p.m. A contractor that was heading home from Francoisnia, I hope I pronounced that right, said that they saw a young person. This person was... moving quickly on foot eastbound on Route 112. This was about 4 to 5 miles east of where Mara's vehicle was actually discovered. The witness says that the person was wearing jeans, a dark coat, and a light-colored hood. He didn't immediately report this sighting because he was actually confused about the dates and times that he saw this person. It was 3 months later that when he was overlooking his work reports that he realized that he saw this young person the same time frame and everything that Mara went missing. Just before 8 p.m., EMS and a fire truck came to clear the scene. By 8:49 p.m., her car had already been towed to a local garage. And by 9:30 p.m., the responding officer had left. There was also a rag that was stuffed in the muffler of Mara's vehicle, and this rag was thought to be part of her road assistant kit. Police initially reported this as a missing persons case at 12 p.m. the next day, which was officially 24 hours from the last reported visual of Mara. At 12:36 p.m. the following day on February 10th, a Be on the Lookout was issued for Mara Murray. She was reported as wearing jeans, a dark coat, and a black backpack. At 3:20 p.m., a voicemail was left on Fred Murray's personal answering machine stating that Mara's vehicle was found abandoned. He was working out of state and he didn't receive that message, but his other daughter called him around 5 p.m. and gave him the news. Fred Murray then contacted Haverhill Police Department. They told him that if Mara was not reported safe by the next morning, that the Fish and Game Department of New Hampshire would start a search. Then at 5:17 p.m., Mara was first referred to as a missing person. This was done by the Haverhill Police Department. On February 11th, Mara's dad arrived in Haverhill before dawn. At 8 a.m., New Hampshire Fish and Game, the Murrays, and others began to search. So they brought police dogs out, and the police dogs tracked her scent using one of her gloves 100 yards east from where her vehicle had been discovered. But then the dogs lost the scent. This suggests that Mara got in another vehicle and left. At 5 p.m., Mara's boyfriend and his parents arrived in Haverhill, and the police interrogated him first by himself, and then he later joined his parents, and they were all questioned. At 7 p.m., police stated that they believed that Mara came to that area to either run away or commit suicide, but her family did not believe that. So her boyfriend turned his phone off when he was on his flight to Haverhill, and sometime during the flight, he received a voicemail that he thought was Mara sobbing over the phone. That phone call was traced as coming from a calling card that the American Red Cross issues. And that really has my wheels turning in my head, because if it was her, then, you know, she made it to the Red Cross. Where did she go from there? Like, this case, y'all, has got so many ups and downs and twists and turns, and I don't even know what to believe or what happened, and we gotta find this girl. On February 12th, Mara's dad and her boyfriend released an evening press conference. This was held in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. And the next day, the first press release was published. At 3:05 p.m., police reported that Mara may be headed on Kankamagus Highway area. I hope I said that name right. She was also listed as endangered and possibly suicidal, and police also believed that she was intoxicated at the crash site. But the bus driver that saw her, that stopped to check on her, reported that he didn't think that she seemed impaired. The Haverhill police chief stated that, quote, "Our concern is that she is upset or suicidal," end quote. A week after she disappeared, Mara's father Fred and her boyfriend were interviewed by CNN's American Morning. Her family was upset that the Vermont Police Department had not been informed of her disappearance, because all signs pointed that she could be headed that way. You know, she had directions to go to Vermont, and she had been calling to check in about motels. So all signs were pointing to Vermont, and the police there had not been informed of her disappearance. So her family, they ended up expanding their search into Vermont. Normally missing persons cases are handled by local and state police, but the FBI joined in on the investigation 10 days after she disappeared. The FBI interviewed her family from Massachusetts, and the Haverhill police chief, he announced that her search was now nationwide. 10 days after her disappearance, New Hampshire Fish and Game conducted a second air and ground search. The helicopters used a thermal tracking camera in this search, and they were also cadaver dogs and search dogs. Mara's older sister found a ripped white pair of women's underwear on a secluded trail. This trail was near French Pond Road, and this was on February 26th, but DNA tests later revealed that the underwear did not belong to Mara. Okay, so this coming up. So on February 26th, the items that were found in Mara's vehicle, they were returned to Mara's family, but I'm just trying to figure out, like, they end up coming back later and getting those items for forensic testing, but wouldn't all of the evidence that was on those items, wouldn't they be gone after so long? Like, why did they let her family have those items before they forensically tested them? That is really weird in my head. Like, I don't understand that. Maybe y'all could give me some insight on that, because that is just not clicking right in my head. So on March 2nd, Mara's family checked out of their hotel, but her dad returned almost every weekend to continue searching. In April, the Haverhill police told Fred Murray, Mara's dad, that there were reports of trespassing on private property. Y'all, I feel so bad for this man. Like, he was determined to find his daughter, which, I mean, yeah, I would be the same way. But it just, my heart goes out to him. You know, they never found her. They still haven't found her to this day. And it's just, it's so sad. I feel so bad for her dad. So in March of 2004, another girl, Brianna Matlin, went missing in Montgomery, Vermont. And there were a lot of similarities in these cases, so there were comparisons made. So the two places where these girls went missing, Montgomery, Vermont, and the Woodsville area where Mara went missing, were 66 miles apart. The state police eventually stated that there were no connections in the two cases. In April and again in June, Vermont and New Hampshire state police said that there were no connections in the two cases. In a press release, the police stated that they believed that Mara was headed to an unknown destination and that they believed that she possibly got a ride in another vehicle to continue to this destination. They added that there had been no evidence that a crime had been committed, and they had also dismissed the idea of a serial killer being involved. So on July 1st, this is when police go and retrieve the items back from Mara's family that they had given her that was in her vehicle. So they give the family these items that were in the vehicle, and then in July they take them back, and they do that to do forensic testing. I'm so confused about that whole aspect right there. On July 13th, almost 100 searchers did a 1 mile radius search. This search included rescue personnel, state troopers, and volunteers. So this was the fourth search that they had done, but it was the first search that they had done where there was no snow on the ground. The police were really concerned about finding her backpack that was reported of being with her, but they stated that there was no conclusive evidence. Okay, so this next part, it's a little, I don't know, just kind of makes your wheels turn. So in late 2004, a man allegedly gave Fred Murray, Mara's dad, a rusty knife that belonged to his brother, the man's brother. He said that his brother had a criminal past, and he lived less than a mile away from where Mara disappeared from. He said that his brother and his brother's girlfriend were acting strange after the disappearance. The man said that he believed that his brother used that knife to kill Mara. And several days after the knife was given to Fred Murray, the man's brother allegedly scrapped his Volvo. So his family says that that is not true. They said that the man gave the knife to Fred Murray because he wanted to get reward money. They said that he made the story up. I don't know. That's just a weird, that whole situation right there with the knife and everything. It's weird. The man could have made it up, but like, why? Like, that's a weird thing to make up. I don't know. My brain doesn't work that way. I also want to make this clear before we go any further in this case. I am not accusing anybody because I really have no clue what happened to this girl. It's a sad situation, but there are a lot of things to question and a lot of weird, you know, characters that come into this investigation, and these are just things that cross my mind. But I am not by any means accusing anybody because I don't know. The man's family also reported that he had a history of drug use. So in 2005, Fred Murray petitions the New Hampshire Governor Craig Benson for help in the search. He also appeared on the Montel Williams show in November of 2004 to publicize the case. And if y'all are old enough to remember the Montel Williams show, you know that that was a good way to get this case out into the public, because Montel Williams, man, he was it back in the day. I remember him, and you know, this was probably one of the best ways he could have gotten her case out there at this time. So on the 1 year anniversary of the disappearance, there was a service held at the spot where her car was discovered. Her dad, Fred Murray, also briefly met with the New Hampshire Governor John Lynch. So in late 2005, Fred Murray filed suit against several law enforcement agencies with the hopes of seeing reports on the disappearance, files and reports. On November 1st, 2005, a user with the name Tom Davies logged into a message board, and the name of the message board was Not Without Peril. This message board was dedicated to Mara and helping find her. Tom Davies claimed that he saw a black backpack behind a restroom at Pemigewasse Overlook. I hope I said that name right. I know I didn't. But this restaurant was about 30 miles east of Woodsville on Route 112, where Mara's vehicle was discovered. So remember, in the beginning, it was reported that she was wearing a black backpack when she disappeared. Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Strelzin stated that he was aware of the black backpack, but he never disclosed if they took the backpack for forensic testing. The New Hampshire League of Investigators, retired police officers and detectives, and the Molly Bish Foundation started working on the case in 2006. Former police chief and member of the Licensed Private Detectives Association in Massachusetts, Tom Shamshak, said, quote, "It appears that the this is something more than a mere missing person's case. Something ominous could have happened," end quote. In 2007, the Arkansas group Let's Bring Them Home offered a $75,000 reward for any information leading to the solving of this case. In October of 2006, volunteers initiated a 2-mile radius search. Approximately 1 mile from the crash site in an A-frame home in the closet, cadaver dogs reportedly went quote unquote bonkers. They were possibly identifying the presence of human remains. This house, coincidentally or not, just so happened to have formerly been owned by the man who was implicated by his brother, who gave the knife to Fred Murray. Remember the rusty knife? Yeah, this house belonged to the brother of the man who gave Fred Murray that knife. So that's just a little So a sample of the carpet that was in that closet was taken. It was sent to the New Hampshire State Police, but it was never publicized what the results of that testing was. In July of 2008, volunteers led another two-day search in wooded areas in Haverhill. This group consisted of dog teams and licensed private investigators. So it's starting to get serious at this point, as if it shouldn't have already been, but here we go. In 2009, Mara Murray's disappearance was one of many cited by proponents of a statewide cold case unit in New Hampshire. Later that year, her case was subsequently added to the new cold case unit. In 2010, Fred Murray publicly criticized the police investigation because they were treating it as a disappearance and not as a criminal case. He also called for the FBI to join in on the investigation. In February of 2009, Jeffrey Strelzin said that the investigation was still active. Quote, "We don't know if Mara is a victim, but the state is treating it as a potential homicide. It may be a missing persons case, but it is being treated as a criminal investigation," end quote. In 2014, on the 10-year anniversary of Mara's disappearance, Strelzin stated that, quote, "We haven't had any credible sightings of Mara since the night she disappeared," end quote. The New York Daily Times published an article on the 10th anniversary of Mara's disappearance. It was reported that Mara's dad, Fred Murray, believed that his daughter was dead and that she was abducted on the night of her disappearance. On February 9, 2017, 13 years after she disappeared, Strelzin wrote in an email to the Boston Globe. In the email he wrote, "It's still an open case with periods of activity, and at times it goes dormant. There are no new leads at this time." In February of 2019, Fred Murray reiterated his beliefs that his daughter was dead, and he also had suspicions about the nearby house where the cadaver dogs went crazy. He stated, "That's my daughter in there, I do believe." In early April, excavation was done in the basement of the house. Initially, Fred Murray wanted to search the house, but the owners at the time did not cooperate. After the property was sold, the new owners allowed several searches at the property. The excavation that was done found, quote, "absolutely nothing other than what appears to be pottery or an old pipe," end quote. Mara Murray's disappearance has been cited as the first crime mystery of the social media age. It also cited speculation, especially on the internet and public forums. Bill Jensen, a writer for Boston Magazine in 2014, now at least online, "It often seems as there's no such thing as a cold case. But when Mara Murray disappeared, social web was in its infancy. There was no YouTube, no Twitter, and Facebook had launched 5 days before Mara disappeared. And so you can read the history of her case as a parable about the evolution of internet sleuthing," end quote. In 2005, active discussions of Mara Murray's disappearance was documented on websleuths.com. And in 2007, Facebook and MySpace pages were created, dedicated to help find her. So that's it. I mean, it's a lot, but it's really not, because there's no answers. Like, where is this girl? She's been missing since 2005. 1974. She was 21 when she went missing. She's almost my age. She was born in 1982. I was born in 1983. So she would be around 38 years old, 38, 39 years old right now. And she's been missing this whole time. And I really have questions about this man with the knife and the house and the closet and these dogs. Like, that is really blowing my mind. I really feel like he's got some kind of connection. I want to know what the forensic evidence came up with that carpet. And, you know, I need to know. I need to know. But unfortunately, we don't at this moment. And I hope that they continue to research and investigate and find out what is going on. I'm sure that they have, you know, all kinds of files and all kinds of documents about this case. And I'm sure that on these files, there is information that the public does not know. And that's fine. But, you know, we're invested. We're invested. 2004, that is 16, 17 years ago. I have a daughter that was born in 2004. So almost 17 years ago, and still no answers. So, you know, I pray that they find this girl. You know, I feel so bad for her family, especially her dad. Man, he has been a soldier through this whole thing. He is determined to find answers, to find his daughter, to find something to give him closure. And I just pray so hard for this family. So anyway, it was a long one today, y'all. I am telling y'all, it was a big one. And I want to give credit to Wikipedia. That is where this information came from. And y'all, thank you so much for listening to my podcast, and please continue to do so. Y'all have a great day. Bye.